Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Members, we do have House File 303 that we still need to take up, but until we have, as soon as we have a quorum, we'll finish that bill up. So, Ms. Lepone, would you let me know when that happens? Okay, so I'm, we've had a lot of discussion in this committee over the years about treatment, about DWIs, about what works, what doesn't, and how, from a public policy perspective, we should be addressing these issues. And I'm very pleased today that we have three individuals who are recognized as leaders in this field. And our first presenter, and I think what I'd like to do is ask you to hold your questions until after the presenter has made their presentation. Did we give 15 minutes maybe for, did we say? About 20, 25 for each presenter. That should give us enough time to ask questions. Carol Falkowski is with the Hazelton Foundation. She's the Director of Research and Communication at the Hazelton Foundation. She's one of 20 researchers in the country who participates in an ongoing drug abuse monitoring network of the National Institute of Drug Abuse. I believe you have their, although I didn't get it. Did you give us? Yes, we did. The for the new members to the legislature, you will be getting this periodically, which is the drug abuse trends in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Ms. Falkowski has published numerous articles and reports on drug abuse trends, and we're pleased to have her bring the committee up to date.
All right, thank you.
Ms. Falkowski?
Yep, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. One of the things, just by way of background very quickly, after 20 years in state government, doing research at various agencies, predominantly with the Department of Human Services and some joint efforts with the Department of Public Safety on drunk driving issues. I've been at the last 10 years at the Hazelton Foundation, which is an addiction treatment, education, and research center. We're based in Center City, Minnesota. We're a nonprofit organization. And we also have facilities in New York, Chicago, and Oregon. One of the things that makes us different from other treatment programs like Betty Ford is that we also have a publishing arm and we also have a research center. One of the things I have done, and I have a copy of my PowerPoint that you should have in front of you too if you want to follow along. It's really small, but you can read it. One of the things I've been involved in, as you mentioned, for 20 years is being part of a group of drug abuse researchers from 20 cities throughout the country who all write reports on drug abuse trends every 6 months and then are convened by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We look at overdose deaths, people coming into treatment programs, and in the Twin Cities I look at the five-county area. Because 20 years ago it was the five-county area, so I kept that. Law enforcement data, and hospital emergency room episodes. So what I want to talk with you today are what I think are sort of the big picture items about drug abuse in Minnesota, to some extent how we compare with other states, and bringing to the table the perspective of someone who's watched different drugs come and go on a regular basis for 20 years. I think it's important to point out, just by way of background, that this is really what it looks like in terms of the population in the United States using different drugs. It's probably no surprise to anyone that over 80% of the population has used alcohol, just over 70% tobacco, and it's really about 46%, and over the years between 46 and 50% of the population who has ever tried an illegal drug. The lion's share of that is marijuana. More recently, we're seeing an increase in the people who have used prescription drugs non-medically. And if you follow that chart all the way down to the column second from the right, there you see it's about 5% of the population that's ever tried methamphetamine. Because the focus today is going to be on driving under the influence of alcohol, I thought I'd throw this chart in that looks at that broken down by age group. And it's no surprise for those of us in the field that the incidence of that is really highest among people in their early 20s, and it dwindles with age. There's a spike there around 40 to 44 years old, midlife crisis, I call that. And when we look at the next one, how do we compare with other states? This comes from the Centers for Disease Control's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. This is pretty interesting. I think we have a perception here that Minnesotans really enjoy their alcohol, and it is actually not just a perception, it's borne out by data. If you look at this broken down by state, you can actually see that in terms of current alcohol use, Minnesota is among the top states, closely behind Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. So it's not just this perception. We really do have larger drinking, a larger proportion of the population who are regular drinkers. If we look at binge drinking, which is five or more drinks on one occasion, the same pattern appears. And when we look at that cluster of states, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, those are the states with the highest rates of binge drinking, which is defined as five or more alcoholic drinks on one occasion or one sitting. We also have local Minnesota-based data. That's the CDC-collected data, and it finds a similar thing. In terms of past month alcohol use there, it's about 60% of the Minnesota population. But if you look at it among 18 to 20-year-olds, you see the highest rates of use among 18 to 20-year-olds. That's not the alcohol use. Oh, that's in the wrong place. That should be binge drinking is 39% among 18 to 20-year-olds. And if we look at people who drink in Minnesota in the past month, about a third of them have one drink a day, a third of them have two drinks a day, and a third of them have three drinks a day. In the terms of patterns of use of alcohol, especially among young people, if there's any trend going on for the past 10 years, it's to drink as much as possible, as quickly as possible, without wasting all that time drinking. So we have things like beer bongs or a funnel that you see in the right-hand corner, where people put a funnel down their throat and a tube connected to a funnel and can drink up to a pitcher of beer at one time. Again, the idea to get as much alcohol in as quickly as possible. We have games like beer pong, where you have a ping pong table and bounce a ball back and forth, and every time it lands in a glass of alcohol, you guzzle it down. Or this game in the lower right-hand corner where people duct tape 40-ounce bottles of alcohol to their hands and can't take them off until they've consumed them. Or alcohol roulette. That's actually a game that was sold by a department store at Christmas time of spinning it and then taking shots of alcohol. Now, these things, you know, happened 20, 30 years ago, but 20 or 30 years ago, it was at parties down by the river, in private homes, and it has become more mainstream now so that you go to public venues of bars and restaurants and see people with beer funnels and things like this. So it's really become more mainstream and more culturally acceptable, not only here but in the rest of the country, to do this extreme drinking and just trying to pound down as much alcohol as possible as rapidly as possible. If we look at a recent study by the University of Minnesota undergraduate students that was conducted in 2006, we look at alcohol. It's broken down between 18 to 24-year-olds and then people 25 and older. You can see, somewhat surprisingly, you don't often see this, for both 18 to 24-year-olds and 25 and older folks, the proportion of females who drink outnumber the proportion of males who drink. It's about equal in terms of marijuana. But again, even in the older age group with marijuana, more women than men report that. And then you see other illegal drugs. In terms of high-risk drinking, and that for students is defined as five or more drinks at any one sitting in the past couple weeks, in the past 2 weeks. Regardless whether they're underage or of legal drinking age, over 40% of students at the University of Minnesota report this. If we look at how that relates to risky behavior, we know that the kids who engage in high-risk drinking have more consequences related to their drinking in terms of missed classes, failing grades, being victims of sexual assaults, being victims of physical assaults, as well as engaging in drunk driving. And this is a pretty compelling relationship here. Among all students, About a quarter of them reported drunk driving. But among the people who were high-risk drinkers, who were drinking heavily, 43% of them reported drunk driving. And that compares to only 12% among the people who were not high-risk drinkers. We also see a relationship between tobacco use and other legal and illegal drug use. This is borne out by surveys that have been conducted, no matter who conducts them. The relationship is such that kids who smoke are much more likely to use illegal drugs and drink than kids who do not smoke. Here in this particular survey, this shows that of the kids who are tobacco users, 71% of them also engage in high-risk drinking, whereas the kids who are not tobacco users, only 34% of them engage in high-risk drinking. That relationship holds true across the older age groups as well. And what this suggests is that many people don't comprehend this relationship between smoking. It's not necessarily causal, as if smoking a cigarette causes you to drink or use illegal drugs. But these are really high associations. And at the minimum, what they suggest in terms of prevention efforts is if we can get kids, if we can delay the onset of smoking, we're also, in effect, reducing the likelihood of individuals from smoking illegal drugs and drinking alcohol. There's a very strong association. But again, we don't know it's necessarily causal or which comes first, the chicken or the egg. In terms of how we compare with other states in terms of smoking, we are right at the national level at about 20-point-some percent of Minnesotans age 18 and older currently smoke. But I think what's notable about this particular slide is looking at California, and look at that rate in California. We are now at a point in 2004 where California's smoking rate is among the lowest in the nation. They were one of the first states to establish smoke-free environments. And we know that what works with kids and smoking is environmental actions can deter smoking by not having a lot of places where they can smoke, as well as young people are the most price sensitive. So when you raise the rates of the cost of a drug, whether it's alcohol or tobacco, rates really go down in use among those who are most sensitive to prices, which tend to be young people who do not have unlimited funds. All right, the next one talks about a Minnesota survey. We're fortunate in Minnesota to have a survey that was conducted in 04 and 05, because the only other survey conducted in Minnesota was conducted in 1989. So this is really current, looking at trends in Minnesota. Unfortunately, our survey looked at people age 18 and older, and the most national surveys look at people age 12 and older, so they aren't directly comparable. But this shows the percent of people in the past year in Minnesota who've ever used these different drugs, but in the past year. You can see marijuana leads the pack, prescription drugs, cocaine, hallucinogens, and their methamphetamine, other stimulants, opium and heroin. I'm going through this real fast, but that's all right. Then we have the next one looks at this broken down by age, and whether we're talking about cigarettes or binge alcohol or marijuana, prescription drug abuse or other illegal drug abuse, consistent with all the other surveys that have ever been done on drug abuse, we do see the highest rates among 18 to 25-year-olds. This is true here as well as in other places. And when we look at the Minnesota survey on drug use, broken down by race, ethnicity, regardless of the drugs, again, whether it's cigarettes, binge alcohol, marijuana, prescription drugs, or other illegal drugs, we have the highest rates among American Indians. When you look at drug use among high school seniors, I just want to summarize briefly some of the trends. I already mentioned with alcohol, the trend is to drink as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and that our rates are among the highest in the nation. By the time kids graduate from high school, about 73% have already tried alcohol. Over half of the kids have already been drunk. With marijuana sends more patients into addiction treatment programs in the Twin Cities than any other illegal drug, and this has been the case for at least 15 years. Half of those folks are under the age of 18. So if people suffer from this idea that marijuana is somehow not an addictive drug, there is no science to base up that fact. Nationwide, over 300,000 people enter addiction treatment programs every year with marijuana as their primary drug. All right. In terms of the other big drug trend going on here as well as nationally, it involves the non-medical use of prescription narcotics. I think as a backdrop to this, we live in a world where over 5 million school-age kids take a prescription drug every day for some sort of behavior disorder. We have direct-to-consumer advertising of pills, and pills are really part of the world in which people live, and kids learn at a very early age that if you want to take a pill, you get a mood change. So when they look for things to take recreationally, they tend to turn to what's available, and we increasingly live in a world where prescription drugs are part of that mix. And the next one is methamphetamine. Clearly, I'm going to be talking more about this. It's not just rural. It's not just an adult problem, and there are regional variations across the country. What is that noise?
Ms. Belkowski, maybe
does that mean you have
if a member does have a cell phone on, you can turn it off. That's probably the noise.
There's a tornado. It's a blizzard. Okay. I had to ask. What we know now that we didn't know when many of us were young people comes, and I think this is really critical, comes from the National Longitudinal Epidemiological Study that looked at tens of thousands of people over the course of their lifetime about their drinking and drugging behavior. And it found something that's pretty interesting. It found that people who first start drinking before the age of 15, drinking to intoxication, that those people, 40% of them, develop the disease of alcoholism in the course of their lifetime. Whereas the people who first started drinking to intoxication around the age of 20 and 21, only 10% of them develop the disease of alcoholism, more like it is in the general population. Now again, we know the likelihood of anyone becoming addicted is a combination of genetic predisposition that explains about 50% of it, and environmental factors. But at the minimum, what this research suggests, again, is that if you can delay the age of first use, not only are you reducing the likelihood of all the stupid, impaired things that people do while they're under the influence of alcohol, but you also reduce the likelihood of someone developing the disease of addiction in the course of their lifetime. We know that the number one long-term effect of drug abuse is addiction, and this is my favorite definition, a chronic disorder with behavioral components that requires lifelong management and periodic professional services. So in that way, it's like other chronic diseases. If you have them for your lifetime, you have to change your behavior. They don't go away, and you periodically need to get help with them. I'm going to skip the definition between abuse and dependency. I put it in there for your reference. But when we look at the most recent data we have on the prevalence of substance use disorders in the state of Minnesota, about 8% of the population has either alcohol abuse or dependence, and that translates to 329,000 Minnesotans. If we look at drug abuse or dependence, about 2% of the population, or 90,000 Minnesotans fit the criteria for drug abuse or dependence. Sizable numbers of people. Now, we have all, even though alcohol is the most prevalent drug of abuse and marijuana the most prevalent illegal drug of abuse, we certainly have been aware of the increased impact of methamphetamine in Minnesota. This is just a summary chart, and I'm sure being on this committee you are well aware of these numbers, so I'm not going to dwell on any of them. But whether we're looking at arrests or meth labs or people coming into treatment or prison, there has not been a system that has not been significantly affected in the past 5 years by methamphetamine abuse. I want to talk a bit about how people take it, because methamphetamine is not a new drug. It has been around for a long period of time. Just as cocaine was not a new drug 20 years ago. But what switched that really propelled what became known as the cocaine epidemic in this country was that people started smoking cocaine as the route of administration in the form of crack. So too, what this graph shows is how there's been a switch in how people use methamphetamine, so that more people are now smoking methamphetamine. And for those of us who monitor drug trends and get together on a regular basis and try to understand what's going on based on all the available data, we think that absolutely the switch to smoking is a route of administration, because smoking delivers the drug very rapidly to the brain and is very rewarding. We think that this route of administration of smoking meth has really contributed to its spread to other parts of the country other than just the southwestern states. When we look at meth use for different states, I wanted to put this in so you can see where Minnesota fits, sort of right in the middle. But if you look at the Northeast and some of the more eastern states, there are lower rates. But even in the highest states, the red states, it's still no more than 2% of the population that is used in the past year. This shows where Minnesota ranks. But if we look at this broken down by people 18 to 25, this is where Minnesota ranks higher. And in fact, Minnesota is third highest in terms of meth use in the past year among 18 to 25-year-olds. If we look at people coming into treatment, another indicator of drug abuse, this is the Twin Cities. The left circle is in the year 2000. And you can see in the year 2000, about 3% of people coming into treatment were there for meth. That grew to about 13% by 2005. But look at this. This is an interesting one. This looks at people coming into treatment in the Twin Cities area, and look, there in the first half of 2006, we see a significant decline in the number of people coming in for methamphetamine. This is really a hopeful indicator in the sense that this is preceded by 10 years of increase, and now finally it's declining. If we look at hospital emergency department episodes, there's methamphetamine behind cocaine and marijuana. This is 2005. But if we look at the next one, 2006, you can see how methamphetamine has fallen down, and it's really much lower. This is another sign that perhaps suggests that methamphetamine use may be declining. You can see how it has fallen down in rank. I'm going to skip the death one. So I want to spend the last couple minutes talking about what makes meth different. We know that all addiction can precipitate mental disorders in people who are otherwise predisposed. But with meth addiction, almost everyone who becomes addicted to methamphetamine develops severe paranoid delusions. The pattern of use is such they go for days at a time without eating or sleeping, and they become paranoid and delusional. And it is this aspect of methamphetamine abuse that makes meth addicts such a heightened threat to public safety, unlike people addicted to other drugs. They're out for long periods of time, they're reacting to things that aren't really there, and that's what makes them so dangerous. Another thing that makes meth different is that it appeals to a broad spectrum of potential users, not just drug abusers who take it to feel good or to feel better. Some people are attracted to methamphetamine who simply want to take it because it is a long-acting stimulant that heightens alertness and reduces fatigue. Some people also take it just because they want to lose weight. I was on the Today Show last year with a woman who was a middle-class woman from a suburb in California, who was introduced to meth by her neighbor, who said, you know, you have three kids, you're always complaining about being chubby, just smoke this meth in the morning with your coffee and you can lose weight. Now, this woman had no history of drug or alcohol abuse, and she very innocently but very stupidly started smoking meth. She did lose the weight in about 3 months, but she also, within about 6 months, became addicted, and it took her about a year to get over that addiction and get her family back. But this is another thing that makes meth different. The people who are attracted to it are not just people who would otherwise be attracted to other drugs. Some people are high achievers, they work multiple jobs, or they work back-breaking jobs, and they just want to have less fatigue. Another thing that makes meth different is that we have child abuse, endangerment, and neglect due to multiple factors, not just because the primary caregiver is addicted, but also the pattern of use with meth addiction is such that people go for days at a time without eating, without sleeping, and you think of what defines life for children, things like getting up and going to bed. You know, it's the pattern of use that contributes to it as well as if they're manufacturing it, the environmental exposure. So people, these three factors contribute to why we see some of the most extreme cases of child abuse, neglect, and endangerment in the homes of meth-addicted caregivers. We also know that meth is different because of the meth production, as well as the legislative responses. Prior to the federal Combat Methamphetamine Act that was passed in March of last year, 34 states, including this one, had passed restrictions on Sudafed. You can see nationwide the decline, even preceding the federal law in meth labs. And if we look at Minnesota data, we see where our state law became effective in and then the subsequent decline since then. Another thing that makes meth different is the speed which it took hold among adolescents in Minnesota. And in fact, kids in Twin Cities high schools, more of them reported using methamphetamine in 04 than reported using it nationally. Meth is a drug that's very attractive to kids because, unlike other drugs, this makes kids feel like Superman. It makes them feel alert and awake. It lasts a long time. It gives them confidence and energy, and it's available and affordable. It has a very strong attraction to kids. But when we look at people coming into treatment, even though kids constituted 11% of people coming into treatment for meth in 05, by 06, that had dropped to 4%. So again, we're wondering if this possibly suggests a decline in youth methamphetamine abuse. Another thing that makes meth different are the number of myths that people have about the treatment about methamphetamine. Hazelden, as a leader in addiction treatment, has delivered congressional briefings in Washington, D.C., both on the House side and the Senate side, about the efficacy of treatment, including treatment for methamphetamine. Jim Ramstead and Representative Kennedy sponsored the Meth Treatment Outcomes 1 in Washington in 05, where we sat and presented information on treatment along with the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. Senator Coleman's Meth Town Hall was in January of last year, where we sat alongside Nora Volkow, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, talking about meth treatment. We talked about how effective...
Ms. Volkowski, can you finish up here? Because we have some questions, and we have more presenters and a bill here. So
give me 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, we talked about how effective treatment exists, how it's comparable to outcomes of treatment for other chronic disorders. And do all meth addicted patients need inpatient treatment? Absolutely not. Do all of them need longer treatment? It really boils down to an individual assessment, as it does with anyone with a chronic disease. How much treatment you need depends on the progression of the disease and the characteristics of the person. What also makes meth different is the unprecedented community mobilization, public education that's gone on around it within Minnesota, and we hope that this contributes to the declines that we're seeing. Again, there have been significant declines that reverse upward trends, and the questions are, can these be maintained over time? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Volkowski. A quick question, then Representative Lesch. I'd just be curious, what's Minnesota doing right, and what direction do you think we should be going relative to dealing with the drug addiction and alcohol abuse? What are we doing right, and what could we do differently?
Well, I think we know that the key to long-term drug-free recovery involves treatment as well as aftercare. So I think what we're doing right is doing everything we can, including looking at different ways of funding, to get more people the treatment they need. I think that's one of the things we are doing right in the state of Minnesota, and we have a long tradition of that. I think what we can do better is look at what we can do to give people beyond just 28 days some supported living situations that really help them get on their feet. We know that the prognosis, especially for meth addicts, is poor when, even if they finish treatment, they go back to an environment where people are stopping by selling drugs, using drugs, and making drugs. And I think we need to look at different creative ways of giving people more of a chance. I think expanding the challenge incarceration program and looking at more treatment options in prison is another direction we need to go as well.
Thank you, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Volkowski. It was interesting when you were talking about the slide route of meth administration, and the blue line at the bottom related oral routes of administration, which is the lowest, but does that take into account legal oral use? And I ask that because it's my understanding is there is an oral type of ADD medication, I forget the name of it, that is essentially methamphetamine.
Right. The only way that would be included in this chart if it were the non-medical use of it, otherwise prescription drugs.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mullery?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, are you saying that the what I'm here quoted a lot from different representatives here, including ones that carry the meth bill, was that meth is untreated, and I know that was in that stand, the greatest medical journal of all time, Rolling Stone magazine, said that meth is untreatable, and I hear that quoted a lot around here from representatives. Is that not correct? Or
that is not correct. That is not correct. I mean, I have heard that in the halls of this building as well as across the street. And as far as I can tell, as a professional who pays attention to this for a living for decades, there's even a figure that has been attributed to that. I have heard people say only 6% of meth addicts ever get better. And as far as I can tell, that does stem from an article in the Rolling Stone magazine in January of 2002. But it's like a rubber spider. You know, you can't really step it out because it's not real, but it just keeps going. And it's been used at the national meeting of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It just keeps going, but there is no scientific foundation in that. In fact, I would, given that I've addressed, U.S. Congress about meth treatment outcomes, I would welcome the opportunity to be able to address bodies over here about that as well, because there's a lot of misconception about it. And I think one of the things that it does is remove hope for people who have families. I think it's also important to know that whether the drug is methamphetamine or alcohol, it is really the norm that in addiction treatment that many times more than one treatment episode is the norm. And that's why I passed out another handout, The Principles of Addiction Treatment. It's a 12-item list from the National Institute on Drug Abuse that I would really encourage you to look at. It's state-of-the-art science based on treatment.
Representative Haas, and then we're going to stop for now, and Ms. Falkowski after that, if you could stay, that would be great. Representative Haas,
thank you very much. I was being pestered here by Representative. No, I do have a question. A few years back, when all this, actually, it goes way back. I think it was called Crank back when I was around a long time ago. But recent back, the rural areas were having their labs behind the barns and so forth, and that was really rapid. And that has been fought. Now I understand that even meth now is outsourced and is coming in from Mexico. Is that correct?
Ms. Bukowski.
It has always been the case that the lion's share of meth in the state has come from out of it. Even when people were producing it themselves, it was only about 20% of the supply.
Thank you,
Ms. Bukowski. Thank you, members. Mr. Simon will be next, but we're just going to quickly finish up this bill. Hopefully it won't take too long. And if you could stay, Ms. Bukowski.
Yep.
Representative Paymar has provided an author's amendment as known as A2. Would somebody please move the author's amendment?
So move.
Motion by Haas. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendments carried. Representative Paymar, will you proceed?
Chair members, briefly, I think we've already introduced the bill. As you know, this would provide an additional appropriation to YIPA for $4 million over the biennium. $4 million over the biennium. Suggestions by Representative Eastland and Representative Biskins, we have, I think, makes the bill better and provides the intent behind House File 303. And we've incorporated that into the amendment. When I first came to this body, members, we used to say we should be spending $1 for treatment and prevention and intervention for every dollar we spend on the courts and the Department of Corrections. Well, we're not doing that. We probably never will do that. But I think that this is a step in the right direction to provide some additional funding to programs around the state. I do want to say I don't think that DPS is here, but it is my intent to ask the Department of Public Safety to provide this committee with an assessment of how they're going to provide these grants. As you probably know, this money used to be in DEED, and so the Department of, what was it?
Economic Development.
The Commissioner of DEED would create them the oversight committee that would evaluate the programs that fell under the auspices of YIPA. So I would like DPS to bring that information to the committee and also to make sure that we're not duplicating services with any of this additional money. That's important to me. And Mr. Beatty, you have like a minute to
right.
Comment.
Just a couple comments that I would like to make, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We passed around a couple. There was a couple questions yesterday after the meeting, and sometimes it gets kind of confusing the difference between YIPA and the Youth Intervention Program. And so I'm trying to. I gave you a brochure. You should have it in your hands, and it's a brochure on the Youth Intervention Programs Association and sort of the difference, because we're an association made up of community-based early intervention programs, and we're here actually advocating and representing for the Youth Intervention Program, which is administered by the Department of Public Safety and actually through the Office of Justice Programs. And so sometimes people say, you know, it's a bill for YIPA. It's actually a bill for the Youth Intervention Program, not the association, because the association does not administer the funding. The funding is administered by public safety. In fact, Tricia Hummel is here today from the Office of Justice Programs if there are any questions. But I think I also gave you another one-page handout that hopefully tries to clarify some of the questions that came up yesterday. About what we're trying to do. A couple things that I think from YIPA's perspective, you know, we've identified particular areas of the state where we really feel is important. And if you remember looking at that brochure with the map inside there yesterday, but there's areas of Minneapolis, North and South Minneapolis, that we feel really needs some additional programs as far, and also areas of St. Paul, the inner city of Duluth, the American Indian reservations, and then underneath, we've identified some of the cities that we really feel could use these kind of programs. So I just wanted to kind of bring this to your attention, and I've also got YIPA's board chair, Dan Farr, here today, so if you have any questions about our association versus the Youth Intervention Program, we can hopefully clarify some of those questions you might have.
I believe Representative Mulroy has a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer it, the author said that it went to YIPA, and my understanding was that it's for youth intervention programs in general, and that the department could, because I talked to Mr. Farr yesterday, and my concern is that I think there might be some that aren't within your program groups that might be ones deserving of receiving money. And that was my understanding from talking to you yesterday, that this isn't just the YIPA organization groups, that there could be others that the department would.
Yeah, the way it operates is that
Could you state your name for the record?
Dan Farr, P-F-A-R-R. The YIP grant comes out. Everybody is eligible to apply. They have to meet the criteria of the grant. They do not have to be a member of the association in order to get funding. So if there are groups within districts, cities, police departments, all these folks will get the RFP statewide. And they have to meet the need of the grant. They have to show the need of the community, and then they're eligible to receive funding. And we currently have groups in the state who receive YIP funding who are not a part of the association. Obviously, we want them to be a part of the association because, from my standpoint, and I also work with Boulder Options, the association is one of the only forms that gathers on a statewide level to provide technical assistance, training, and evaluative forms that we can get together and do best practices together. So, you know, I'm biased to belonging to the association, but nobody's required to do that.
Any follow-up? Representative Iskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Chairman Paymar, just for the record, when I read the original bill, I really thought it was a reaching across the aisle and, you know, we're going to work with Commissioner Campion and if you give him $4 million. So I have, you know, I'm making the change. I wasn't sure that's what you wanted to do, all right? And so that's why I brought up the change. But, you know, whether it's a better bill now or not is really a matter of interpretation. I don't know if the Commissioner thinks it's better or it was better when he had $4 million in his hands. But, no, I appreciate and I knew what the intent was and appreciate the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Iskins.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Chair Owen and Chair Paymar, and probably more for you and DPS. After the legislative auditor's report on grants and some of the grant programs, just for maybe my sake some of the committee members' sake, for comfort, will the grant process and after having the folks from YIPA and from the Boulder options here, I have no qualms, no worries at all about how they're spending the money and using the grant program. My concern is in some of the new programs. You know, the auditor's report found a tremendous amount of lack of oversight. I think the governor, and there's a bipartisan bill moving out now that brings a lot of, I guess, light of day or at least accountability, just track back on some of these grants that are going out. So I'm just curious, and I'm hoping, I'm assuming that you will, but just for purposes of the committee when we're talking $4 million, that this new grant language that will come in will be applied, and then maybe for me and some of the committee members to reassure us that those not the two members here, but some of those other grant programs that are going to be applying have that similar, if it's nothing else, reporting back, but a tracking of where the grant money is going to be going.
As part of the YIP grant, and we are a grantee at Boulder Options, we are required to do both evaluation and financial reporting to the Department of Public Safety. And it is, of all the grants that we do, state, federal, private, foundation grants, it is in the upper end of the reporting requirements for us. And so it's monitored very well. Okay. Any new grantees, of course, have to follow that formula. And we as an association believe that that is the right way to do business. And if all the other grant programs in the state operated the way that we did, we wouldn't be talking about that. Yeah. I think they should operate that way.
Okay, we've got three more questions, and we'll try to cut this off short. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will one of you please refresh my mind on what the current appropriation is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the current appropriation is $1,652,000. And that goes to 54 community-based agencies. There was a packet yesterday when we gave you that packet. We got a one-pager from the Department of Public Safety that split out the amounts of the grants annually that each organization gets, and I think the majority of them get about $33,000 at this point, and there's all the way down to 12. And again, that sort of depends on when they come in. Like if there is new money, they have to talk to their communities, find that matching dollars, and then apply for the funding. So it's, they really must go back to their community and find those $2 for every dollar they're going to apply for in that new money.
And Mr. Chair, is that $1,652 million for the biennium or for the current year?
That's Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. That's per year, $1,652 million per year.
Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, I was a little confused about where this money has been in the past. You mentioned deed. Is the $1.652 million, had that been in deed, and now we're looking to move it to public safety, or can you I want to follow the money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coles, it's already been moved to under the auspices of DPS.
Okay.
That's why I want OJP to provide the committee with an assessment of how they evaluate programs, because it might be different than the way DEED did. But I'd rather not take committee time to have them do that, if that's okay.
No, thank you for the clarification. I just wanted to understand where it had been. Thank you.
Okay, last question, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question has been asked and answered, so I'll pass.
Mr. Chair, then, if there's no further questions, I guess I would ask you to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
The chair will lay the bill over for consideration in the omnibus bill at a future date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Given that we had that bill, we're going to have to cut back the presentations just a slight to about 20 minutes each to provide an opportunity for members to ask questions. I'll just introduce Professor Simon while he's getting set up here. For those of you who have been on this committee, Professor Simon is no stranger to this committee. He's the Professor of Clinical Instruction at the University of Minnesota Law School. He's the founder and director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force, and he has conducted research and published extensively in the area of DWI and traffic safety. So, Mr. Simon, you want to just proceed, or is your system?
I passed out. You have my slides.
Yep, they're passed out.
Thank you for this opportunity. What I want to do is give you some rough perspective of the demographics of DWI, the arrest rates, some recidivism data, some crash data. I do have in my slide a review of the structure of the DWI law, but for time constraints, I think I'll move through that fairly quickly and talk about what we know about the different interventions, the different ways in which our law is applied and how that affects recidivism. Some demographics first. You have to drive about 500 to 1,000 times, 500 to 1,000 times to be arrested for DWI. When you look at the number of police officers on the road and the number of people on a Saturday night who are driving under the influence, we're catching a small number. And that, keep that in mind, because in a few minutes I'm going to talk about the significance of the arrest rate and how often or how likely our people are to drive under the influence of alcohol. The recent data from 2005, we don't have the 2006 data yet, but 37,000 people arrested. 2006, by the way, arrested over 40,000. But you'll see that most of the people arrested were first-timers, and in fact, we're seeing for the first time a greater percentage of first-timers than repeat offenders. We don't know if this is a one-year anomaly or if this is a trend. But as you look at the level of offenses, second-timers are 7,000, third-timers are second-timers are about 8,000, third-timers are about 3,500. Each offense level is half the size of the population below it. We don't understand this clearly, whether it's a statistical artifact or whether people are just dropping out. We do know from addiction research that a significant percentage of people just stop drinking abusively all on their own. Okay. Taking a look at alcohol-related fatalities in Minnesota in 2005, there are about 200. Note the number of injuries. The press seems to focus on the alcohol-related injuries, on the alcohol-related deaths. But for every alcohol-related death in Minnesota, there are about 20 alcohol-related injuries. And that really shows you the size of the problem. This is a public health problem with that level of injury. Another very important dynamic is that when we look at alcohol-related fatalities, about 34% involve a repeat offender. And that's what the legislature focuses on, where when you design your laws so that when our courts get their hands on a DWI offender, what can we do so that person doesn't subsequently become involved in a crash? A whole set of whole different dynamics in terms of how to reduce first-timers, first-time crashes. But the thrust of what I'm going to be talking about is what are we doing, what can we do to reduce this figure. Okay. Another important dynamic is that about 70 or 80% of the alcohol-related fatalities in Minnesota occur on rural roads or rural-type roads. It's the nature of the road, undivided highways, sharp curves, lower seatbelt use, much longer detection time. But that's where the majority of the crash, the alcohol-related fatalities are occurring. And different challenges. One size does not fit all. I'll mention that later on when we talk about different court programs. Difference in terms of resources and court calendars in the metro area versus rural. And I'm going to skip through the DWI law. Basic structure, the first offense is, this one slide kind of shows up nicely. First offense is a misdemeanor with a license revocation. Second offense is a gross misdemeanor with license revocation and plate impoundment. Third offense is a gross misdemeanor, license revocation, plate impoundment, and vehicle forfeiture. And the fourth offense is a felony, license cancellation, which is a much longer period of time. The person has to jump through many, many more hoops in order to get relicensed, plate impoundment, and forfeiture. So that's the basic structure of our criminal and our civil law. Interesting note that with our felony DWI law, a recent addition is that once a person has a felony DWI, either because of priors or if they're involved in a DWI involving death or injury, even if they have no priors, if they're arrested again for DWI, and that was rather dramatically shown in a recent case, the Malik Seely case, once you have a felony DWI, all subsequent DWIs will always be felonies. Refusal to take a test in Minnesota is a crime. We're one of four states that have adopted that very, very important law. Repeat offenders quickly learn that they're not going to take the test because that they get convicted. And it used to be a very safe haven, and they would be successful in getting acquitted. In the early 80s, the legislature made refusal a crime. It's been extremely effective. We've done research on it. The police like it. Courts like it. And it really, really increases conviction rates. And it's particularly effective for repeat offenders. A very, very important law. Very important law. And it's worked well. It's an excellent tool for the courts to allow the courts to get jurisdiction over high-risk individuals. We have enhanced penalties for high BACs, or actually high ACs, alcohol concentration, 0.20 or greater, as a gross misdemeanor. Many states that have these enhanced penalties basically set their enhanced penalty at twice the legal limit for the base law. So our legal limit was 0.10, that's what we came to 0.20. There is some focus, some interest in perhaps lowering the enhanced penalties to 0.16. That would have some significant costs because, as you'll see in a minute, the distribution and the average alcohol concentration rate. And it's important to note that even with just a misdemeanor, the court has plenty of jurisdiction over the individual should they choose to do certain things. We have the felony DWI involving death or injury, depending on whether it's a death is the highest penalty in terms of length of time, great bodily harm, a substantial bodily harm. And then a recent law adopted in Minnesota, because of vehicle technology, seat belts and airbags, people are being hit by drunk drivers and walking away from the crash with no major injuries. And prior to the adoption of this law, if that person had no priors who hit them, they could only be sentenced for a misdemeanor. So the legislature wisely adopted this concept so that if you're in a crash and you injure somebody, and because their car had the technology that prevented a serious injury, the person is still looking at a substantially higher penalty. License and vehicle sanctions, a very important area, and we know they work, and it's important to note, and here this sums up, again, this is one slide, sums up the status of administrative sanctions. First-time offender, a license revocation. Second-time, license revocation and plate impoundment. Third-time, license revocation, plate impoundment, and vehicle forfeiture. It's important to note that our administrative sanctions are enforced by the officer at the time of the arrest, and they're based on an implied consent test failure, 0.08 or greater, or test refusal. One problem is that we have a very high number of people who are taking blood and urine tests. When they take a blood or urine test, the officer cannot revoke the license because they don't know the result. Those revocations are occurring on average about 50 days after the arrest. We have been working with DPS, and a few years ago the legislature allowed a more streamlined process to get the test result from the BCA to DPS to speed up that license revocation process. And again, first offense license revocation is 90 days, test failure, a year for test refusal. Interesting to note that our law for years has said if the person pleads guilty to DWI, whether their license was revoked for test failure or test refusal, the revocation is shortened up to 30 days, a strong incentive for people to plead guilty, very strong. Talk a bit about chemical dependency. Ms. Fakowski talked about some of this, but there's important things from DWI you should know about. Moderate drinking is defined as two drinks a day, every day of the week. If everyone drank moderately, there'd be a 40% reduction in the amount of alcohol consumed. 10% of the people who drink consume 60% of the alcohol. And these are the people that we see in court. And they're drinking 8 to 10 drinks a day. The average DWI offender has an alcohol concentration of 0.15. That's two drinks an hour for 4 or 5 hours, 8 to 10 drinks per drinking session. 18% of DWI offenders are 0.20 or greater. This is a very disturbing percentage. A large percentage of our DWI population, heavy, heavy drinkers. And you're basically chemically dependent. Everybody in this room, if you could get to 0.20, would be in a hospital on a respirator because we would be we could not get to 0.20. Non-habitual drinkers couldn't even get to 0.15. Okay, what works in terms of recidivism? DWI arrest rate. The higher the arrest rate, the lower the number of people who engage in DWI. People have to fear being caught before they fear any punishment. And there's research that's been done for the last 20, 30 years all over the world that shows that the incidence of DWI basically varies. It goes down when the arrest rate goes up. And this is a front-end type of thing. You'll see that when I talk about other things, resources should go at the front end, the arrest rate, license and administrative sanctions at the time of arrest, license and vehicle sanctions. When related to this arrest rate, and we're talking about this population, research shows that a person arrested a second time for DWI has a 80 to 90% probability of being chemically dependent, and it's kind of like, duh. If you've gone through the misery the first time, been arrested, thrown in jail, car towed, paid the lawyer's fees, paid the fine, had your license revoked, and your insurance rates go up, and you go and do it again, you really have a serious problem. The alcohol is more important to you than all these other things. Keep this percentage in mind because I'm going to come back to it a little bit later. Speedy adjudication. We did some fascinating research. It's a classic theory of parenting and criminal law. You know, when your kid misbehaves, you don't say, Eddie, okay, next week we're going to talk about the fact that you just punched a hole in the wall because you're angry. No, we do it now. And it's the same thing with DWI offenders. We have found, we took a look at, this goes back to 95, and we're going to do it again. We found that the speedier, the quicker that people were convicted, and basically that's pleading guilty, the lower the recidivism rate. 0 to 30 days, conviction within 0 to 30 days, they had a 19% recidivism rate. 6 months or longer adjudication time period, 26%. And we did it for all offense levels. We did it by offense level. We did it by different judicial districts. So we got a very good picture of this, and consistently we saw that this is borne out. The quicker you get these people adjudicated, this is for first-timers. Hennepin County, talking about speedy adjudication, about in 2005, Hennepin County adopted their speedy adjudication program for DWI offenders. There, when a DWI offender makes their first appearance in court, they are given a trial date no more than 45 days after that date. And the court has been pretty good about sticking to that. They're in the process of evaluating that effect on recidivism, and they'll have those results soon. There's some problem with rural courts being able to move cases through the system quickly, and they're structural. It's not like purposeful delay. It's just that low number of calendars, judges are not in the county every day, every week. But speedy adjudication is a powerful dynamic. We also took a look at speedy administrative sanction and the difference between a quick license revocation and a delayed license revocation. And we found that the people who were revoked at the time of the arrest, that's basically test failure by the breath test or test refusal, had a substantially lower recidivism rate than people who were revoked 2 or 3 months later because of a blood or urine test. Same thing with plate impoundment. We took a look at plate impoundment. People who got a plate impoundment order by the officer at the time of the arrest had a lower recidivism rate than people who got that delayed impoundment order. Assessment. There was a serious problem with the accuracy of assessment nationwide and in Minnesota. Some fascinating assessment research. Basically, assessment is based on the person is asked by the assessor, do you have a problem? They ask a collateral, a wife or a girlfriend, does your husband or wife have a problem? Denial is a basic dimension of chemical dependency, and if all the assessor has is information from the person, they're going to get a lot of what are called false negatives. Some quick, the research, well, I'm going to move right through that, but...
Yeah, Mr. Sutton, we're going to, in order to give Judge Dean some time here, we're going to need to wrap up, and then we can have questions. Is there some, a couple of slides here you want to... Yeah,
sure, I can move through
focus
here.
On? And Representative Lesh, if you could hold your question maybe so Judge Dean can...
Quickly, fines have no effect on recidivism. Jail has no effect on recidivism. Intensive probation programs do work, and they're in law. One of the problems with intensive probation programs is people are choosing to go to jail for a year rather than go to the program. Staggered sentencing, Judge Dean will talk about that. Vehicle sanctions, ignition interlocks work. The recidivism rate is low when they're on it. However, it goes back to what it was before they went on it. Plate impoundment, very effective. Forfeiture, we're doing that research right now. I won't talk about our research with repeat offenders. We fixed the law so it's harder for them to drive someone else's car. Seatbelts, very important. Repeat offenders will buckle up, not for concerns of safety, but if it was primary, they would buckle up so that they would not give the officer a reason to stop them. Alcohol monitoring work, drug therapies work, DBI courts work. Focus on second timers, that's one of my recommendations, that the cost-benefit analysis, I think we can do a lot more there. DWI, not a drop by people under 21. Current law does not require that they be assessed. I think we're missing something there. These are young people. You saw the data from Ms. Falkowski. That's something that should be examined. In summary, there are many cost-beneficial interventions that we can do and are doing that can reduce DWI recidivism. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. Maybe Representative Lesh, you want to ask your question now and then?
Professor Simon, my question was about the recidivism related to those who took the breath test and had immediate license consequences versus those who took blood or urine. My question is that correlation or causation in the sense that I think about the typical person who, you know, wants to make some trouble at the scene and say, I'm not taking a breath test, but I'll do a blood or urine. Does that lend itself to the idea that maybe this person is just a little bit more belligerent in the first place, and that relates to a belligerency on their own alcohol use as well? Or can you say actually that if we had immediate consequences, license consequences, that it would actually result in fewer or less recidivism?
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, it will have an effect. The officer chooses the type of test, and from our research, the main reason the officer chooses the type of test has less to do with the attitude of the defendant and more the officer's concern about not having to be cross-examined on giving a breath test, the closeness of the breathalyzer compared to a hospital. The vast, vast majority of the officers selecting a blood test have nothing to do with the attitude of the defendant.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. If you could hang, stay with us for a few minutes here, and we'll have Judge Dean come up and present, and then we'll open it up for questions. Judge James Dean, members, is an Isanti County judge. He was appointed in 1987. He's a member of the Department of Corrections Felony DWI Advisory Committee, and he served on the 1999 Legislative DWI Task Force and has been noted for some innovations in his court on staggered sentencing. So we're running a little bit behind time, Judge Dean, and I'd like to give members an opportunity to ask three of you questions, but could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Dean. I'm a judge up in Isanti County, and kind of one of my passions is working with DUIs and creating programs that make a difference. In 1993, I had the pleasure of putting the first person on the pretrial electronic alcohol monitoring. It had never been done before in the country. We did it. It's part of the landscape now. We put about 8,000 people on a year. We test them three times a day. Everybody in the state now knows what that is. It. You know what? We don't have to have it. It's okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Fine. You can work without it. In fact, I work without the PowerPoint because I can't. I'm challenged when it comes to that, so please excuse me. But let me tell you what's working and what we need to do and what we need to change. We put 8,000 people on a year on the electronic alcohol monitoring pre-trial and post-trial. One of the things that we need to change, folks, is Minnesota Statute 629.471. That's the maximum bail that we can require people to post. We have to give them the opportunity to post maximum bail. We used to play some games with them where we'd say we have our maximum bail is $12,000 or four times. It's a four times maximum fine, which is $3,000. So we'd say, well, we'll put you on. We'll give you an option. You post $11,500 in bond, and then you test once a day at the jail and do all these other things. Or you can go on the electronic alcohol monitor testing three times a day, no bond. Well, we'd have people come in and say, oh, Judge, we demand the right for our client to post maximum bail. And so maximum bail is $12,000. And people continue to drink and drive posting a maximum bail. Because understand, when we pose maximum bail, we can't require anything of them. They post a maximum bail. We can't even require them not to drink and not to drive and not to get new DUIs. And so I would suggest that that this committee consider as a change upping the maximum bail on DUIs from the 12,000 or four times level to the similar to the domestic abuse, which is six times. If we do that, then the maximum bail would literally raise by 50%, and I can guarantee you the people that we see coming back and violating are the people who post that maximum bail. And if you up that 50%, it's going to make a huge difference in that decision to post $1,800 cash, which they lose. It's like an insurance policy. They lose that money versus $1,200. I think it would make a difference. That's one thing that but electronic monitoring is working. Why? Because it's swift consequences. You're going to hear a lot about an ignition interlock. You're going to hear a lot about even the SCRAM system where they hook it onto your ankle and they measure your sweat every 20 minutes. But the electronic alcohol monitoring that we've started, that we pioneered with the vendors across the state, where they immediately record and send in and fax in the results of a failed test or a person isn't there, where the sheriff's office goes out and picks those up or probation officers go out and pick them up. That's one thing that's working. Second area is staggered sentencing. Professor Simon alluded to that. That's something that I had the pleasure of starting about 8 years ago, and it's very simple. And what we do is we take the actual executed jail that a person would serve. Let's say it's on a third DUI, it's 90 days in jail. On a fourth, maybe 180. Let's say a felony, where we have up to 365 days to work with in county jail. We divide that into three. Three seem to be the answer. Three times a day testing, electronic monitoring is the answer. When we reduced it to two, it failed. Three times a day. For staggered sentencing, we divide it up into three sections. They go on the first third, or let's say an example of 90 days in jail, 30, 30, 30. They serve the first third now. 30 days. They serve the second third 30 days a year from now. They serve the third third 30 days 2 years from now. And, of course, they have the opportunity to bring motions back in front of the assigned judge. That judge who assigns them, one judge, one defendant, is the one who's going to forgive their motion or grant their motion a year from now. Now, what do we do? And then we also put them on electronic monitoring 30 days over Christmas and New Year's every year. They have a right after they've served the first section of that to come back and ask the court to forgive the second and third segments. What we have created, and Jim Cleary did the research back in 2002, in fact, is going to be following up at the end of the session with the new research on staggered sentencing. We have reduced recidivism in the worst offenders, the ones that Professor Simon talks about, those repeat offenders. We've reduced it by 50%. We have saved, as of the 2002 study, an average of $3,500 in jail bed savings. I had sent an email to Commissioner Fabian of DOC a couple years ago saying, I think utilizing that same concept, we could probably reduce 1,500 beds in the state prison. But that's something that's working in the and for DUIs. It's been very successful. NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Association, has sent out their lead researchers to look and see what we've done, and they're recommending it, and we present it all across the United States. The third thing that I'll have a chance maybe in a couple weeks to come and present back to you is, for the last 10 years, I'm kind of anal about this. I've recorded every DWI plea I've taken in Isani County for the last almost 10 years. Nobody's ever done it in the state or in the nation. I just do it, and I've done it. And for 6 years, I didn't know what to do with it. I had all this data, all this research. We didn't know what to do with it. And then we found a little group called the Toward Zero Death, funded by Public Safety. Plugged in, got them. We're working with the bars and the area, the community liquor providers, and we have reduced the last place of drink coming from a bar by, let's see, latest count, 14%, and the BAC reading by 7%, coming from a bar, last place of drink. We've also initiated SafeCam. We'll be coming talking to you in a couple weeks about using some funds. Going back to electronic alcohol monitoring, one of the things that Judge Swenson, who's one of your former legislators, asked me to ask you and consider is we have remote electronic alcohol monitoring funds that the legislature passed several years ago. It started out at $750,000 and was funded 100% by the reinstatement fees of the repeat drunk drivers, or the people getting their license back, 23,000 drivers a year. And that was reduced during the Ventura administration down to $608,000. There was some fiscal problems, and it was reduced down. It's permanent funding, and it comes from the reinstatement fees. We would like to see that back up to the $750,000 level that it was previous to that. When I talked to the administrator of the grants and the remote electronic alcohol monitoring grants that the legislature implemented about 10 years ago allows for indigent defendants to help them pay for the monitoring that we require as judges they to go on. And I know that in talking to the administrator, Ms. Siemens, that he had indicated that he had requests coming in for over $1 million that were valid, but we only had $608,000. So if the legislature would consider raising that up to the $750,000 level it was at several years ago, that would be very helpful for the counties all over the state that are applying for monitoring grants. So with one piece of information that we found surprising, though, in my research in tracking the DUI pleas, while the last place of drink coming from a bar has gone down, while the BAC reading coming from a bar through our education and training has gone down, we found that the drinking at home and the DUIs has gone up. Our BAC levels in our county have gone up by, it's like 16%. Went up from a 0.16 up to a 0.19 during the recording period that we followed. And so I ask people that I work with, I ask students that when I teach some college classes, I say, where is this coming from? What they're telling us is that, well, price of alcohol at the bars is getting more expensive, so they're getting their buzz at home. They're tailgating at home, drinking a lot more at home, and then going into the bar, having a couple drinks. You know, it costs them less. And so that's one of the things, and I guess that's probably the most valid explanation that we're getting. So that's one of the new pieces of information that we find quite puzzling, and we need to do a better job at educating the public at, if you're going to drink at home, either stay at home or get a sober cab.
Thank you, Jeb. Ms. Falkowski, Mr. Simon, would you join Judge Dean? And we've got about 15 minutes, so let's just open it up for questions for any one of the three presenters this morning. Representative Lash? Representative Lash, then Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Dean, my question relates to the last thing you talked about was the drinking at home, or the DWIs from home rising in prevalence. My question is, because that, you know, drinking at home ahead of time, back in college, we used to call that pre-party.
Yeah. And tailgating or pre-party.
Yeah, and, you know, and so my question is, well, we did that, you know, back in the early 90s as well. And is that, you know, you talk with college students, you know, and anecdotal evidence, I'm sure they're doing that now, too, and they say, well, you know, alcohol's too expensive. So can this really be traced with the data to the fact that people are doing that more across all age groups, or are you seeing that more with just college students?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh. This is only a period of DUIs that I've tracked up in Isani County where the change took place within the last 4 years. Up until that point, the average BAC reading at home was about a 1.6. Now, we found out in the last 4 years, the average BAC reading of the DUIs that I have taken that I've recorded has gone up to about a 1.19. I think it dropped slightly down to 0.187. But, you know, we're scratching our head trying to figure out some of the answers for that. Has there always been, you know, drinking at home? Have these exclusively been college? No, these are actually, if I would say, our age still tends to be the national, which is the average tends to be a Caucasian male of age 35. Okay. And they're doing that. They're drinking more at home.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a couple of questions. Judge, how do you square in the data that it just doesn't seem right when you said the last place to drink data has actually dropped? How do you square that with the statement that more people are now drinking at home and then going out somewhere else to have a drink?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's one of those quandaries that we haven't been able to answer. The last place of drinking where a bar was identified as the last place prior to a DUI arrest has dropped, and we've done that, and we've accomplished that through really working with the bars, a coalition, a community coalition, increased training, making them more aware of everything from fake IDs to better serving practices of the local bars. So we've accomplished that. But at the same time, and this is a puzzling thing that I don't have an answer for, but I keep asking college kids if they can give me an answer when I present to their classes, and that's where we're getting some of that information back.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Judge. So we're getting that from college students, but the data would show that you know, maybe because DWIs are becoming more and more expensive, maybe most people are just staying home and drinking, which is kind of what we want them to do. I don't know how you can say they're staying home and drinking a lot and then going to a bar to have the last drink when the last drink at a bar has actually dropped.
Yeah. All right. Judge Dean. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're right. What they're doing is they're driving and getting stopped, maybe on their way to a bar, maybe on their way to a party, maybe on their way to a friend's house on that. So one thing we've accomplished up in Isani County through our Safe Cab program is we have provided hundreds of rides to people from bars to their home, funded by Community Fund, the local bars who are participating, and the local liquor distributors, and that's been a very successful program. We're going to actually seek some funding for some matching grants in the future.
Representative Lee,
One more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Professor Simon, I do have a question about this alcohol home monitoring program. First, I'm nodding to my first time on public safety, so these are some things maybe as general knowledge, but it's new to me. Very new to me that we actually go into the homes of people to monitor if they're alcohol using. Now, does this occur for only the severe? Do we impose alcohol home monitoring only for people who are on like the third or fourth DWI? Or could law enforcement actually monitor what I do in my home after one screw up?
Professor Simon.
I'm going to let Judge Dean answer that because he's been very active in this area, and he can explain who we do it with and why.
Judge.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, I can't see your last name.
You may not be able to pronounce it anyway, Judge.
Thank you. But you get a lot of points on Scrabble games for that
yes.
name. Anyway, Mr. Representative, electronic pretrial monitoring, we do not generally give to first-timers unless they've had a juvenile record and they've got a high reading and they come before us, we'll put them on it right away. It's usually repeat offenders. And is it like Big Brother, they watch everything? No. It's a machine, it's like a video telephone. And they, three times a day, they're expected to blow into the machine, into a straw, and if there's a picture taken of them three times a day, early in the morning, about an hour after work so that they don't stop off at bars and late at night. And it's a traditional program that for 14 years now has been working very well with several thousand drivers. It's become part of, as I said, part of the landscape. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We also, and Judge Dean is one of the big proponents, we use it for people after they're convicted, too. He uses it as part of his staggered sentencing. It's an aid to help them stay sober. But again, it's only for the repeat offenders. Keep in mind that about 60% of the first-timers never come back.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifiers. We heard some data earlier about the relationship between smoking and alcoholism, or alcohol use anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if any of you would care to venture an opinion if the Freedom to Breathe Act gets passed this year and smoking is banned in Minnesota bars. Do you think this will have any effect on DUIs? Will it have any effect on alcohol abuse? Have you given any thought to that?
Ms. Belkowski.
I think it might, and I simply because there's such a long-standing relationship. The kids who are smokers are much more likely to be drinkers and users of other illegal drugs. So it follows then that if somehow these environmental measures that reduce youth smoking, that we will also see an effect in other illicit and alcohol use as well. But there hasn't been any science done on that. It, you know, that's what you would think intuitively, but we really don't know the answer to that.
Judge Dean.
Mr. Representative Liebling, one of the ideas of this increased in at-home BAC readings is the idea that, and was presented to me by Mr. Kapsack, who is the representative of the municipal liquor industries. His thought was that as you stop smoking in the bars, people will continue to party more at home, to go to more at-home type of things, thus the drinking at a home or off, you know, a non-bar facility will occur. So I think we would tend to see an increase in the drinking at home and then driving. And that's what that's one thought on that area.
Mr. Simon, Professor Simon, I asked Ms. Belkowski what she would recommend that the legislature do differently. Do you, in 5 years, do you have any suggestions on what we might do differently to reduce DWIs? I mean, I think there were 40,000 last year, which is quite significant, obviously, due to 0.08. But, and Mr. Cleary, I wish he was here today. I understand he's sick, had some criticisms, I think, of some of our DWI laws. And so, although he supports most of them, what should we do differently?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as I said, enforcement is key, increasing the arrest rate. So providing funds for departments to increase the enforcement rate. Many departments are reducing their patrolling hours, particularly in rural areas, because they cannot maintain the officers on the road. They're not replacing squad cars. They're literally stopping patrolling, you know, each year a little bit earlier. So allowing them to allowing all departments to maintain and, in fact, possibly increase enforcement is very, very important. Better look at first offenders. These are, we have two groups of people, the people that we don't get our hands on before they crash, and then the people who come into court. And there's kind of two separate questions. What can we do to keep people from being DWI the first time? Increasing the arrest rate, more education. Alcohol is to a certain extent price elastic. If the price goes up, there will be some reduction, particularly among youth. Focusing on youth, as I mentioned before, the not a drop on the minor consuming. I think that probably some pilot programs, but if we catch these people early, and Ms. Falkowski can talk about this, the earlier you catch these people and start dealing with their abuse of alcohol, the less likely it is they're going to become chemically dependent.
Thank you. We have three questions, and then we're going to adjourn. Four questions. Representative Biskin, so we'll have to do abbreviated versions here of questions and answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Falkowski, just mentioned a correlation between smoking and drinking, but is it not true that almost any addictive behavior you could show a high correlation between? Would there not be a high correlation to people who, say, gamble and drink and potentially people? We know that addictive behavior, and you mentioned it yourself, there is a genetic predisposition in a number of cases. There's personality predispositions. So making the high correlation between any two addictive behaviors, one could probably show statistical significance. Is that not correct?
Ms. Falkowski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my area of expertise is really drug and alcohol, so I don't know how that translates to other addictive behaviors like gambling. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, for either one of you or all three, what's the one thing we could do to put a license back in the hands as soon as possible of the working stiff that gets popped? At the same time, guarantee the safety of the public. We had a bill on the floor last year. I think Representative Rukavina was here, and some of the unions were worried about employment. And as I am also, I'm a big enforcer of the DWI law, but we don't want to take somebody's livelihood away at the same time, and some of them, you know, their self-worth and respect for themselves, and they lose their job because they can't drive. Is the testing at home the biggest thing we can do, the video machine or something, somewhere where we can get the license back to them so they can go to work but yet still keep the public safe?
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, Cornish,
my game.
Representative Cornish, there's some interesting research that shows that loss of license does not greatly affect employment. People find a way to get to work. If they're going to lose their job, it's often because of their chemical dependency. The longer periods of license revocation, there is the alcohol ignition interlock or alcohol home monitoring. I believe there's going to be a bill before you. I know Senator Latz in the Senate is working on an alcohol ignition interlock to address this issue. But we do have to be concerned about public safety. And there are, as I said, there are things that can be done. But people are not losing their jobs. And keep in mind that the people who get the long revocations are the third-time DWI offender. They're canceled for a year, have to go through treatment. And these are extremely high-risk individuals. Granted, we have to be concerned about them, but we also have to be concerned about public safety. And there are things that can be done.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is probably for Professor Simon. I saw not too long ago a handy little chart that you probably had your fingerprints all over detailing the outline history of DWI law in Minnesota. Which the first one was 1906 or something like that, roughly equivalent to when the automobile came around. And then I saw when we had blood alcohol levels being measured, there was a period where we were at 0.12, I believe, prior to the time we went
to 0.15 was our first.
Mr. Simon.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, if it's 0.15 or if it went to 0.12 after that and then to 1.0 and then 0.08, do we have statistical data showing the rates of recidivism and effects of those changes at the time? And also, When did it go from the last level to 0.10? What year was that, if you can remember that?
Professor Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, it went from 0.15 to 0.10 in the 60s, in the late 60s.
Okay.
And then we stayed there until just about 2 years ago for 0.08. I'm not sure if I understand your question, but we have the average alcohol concentration of people arrested for DWI has been 0.16, and it's been that for many, many years. Repeat offenders tend to have a higher alcohol concentration. I don't know if what your concern is, but the correlation between alcohol concentration and chemical dependency and recidivism correlates pretty. The higher the alcohol concentration at the time of arrest, the more likely it is the person is going to be rearrested again for DWI.
Okay, and just briefly, Mr. Chair.
Is that less?
Thank you. Prisoner Simon, do we have, from that time in the 60s, do we have data relating to any changes now that could be looked at?
Changes in what?
Changes at the time that it changed from 0.15 to 0.10.
Simon.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, we don't have good data because until we adopted the administrative license revocation for test failure, many DWI offenders were able to keep from being identified as a DWI offender by plea bargaining the DWI to a careless driving, and there would only be an administrative revocation for test refusal. So until we adopted administrative revocation in the early 70s, we don't have an accurate picture of the population. Okay. After that, we do.
Judge Dane, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, my research has shown that for over the last 10 years that the average first-timer is about a 1.6. The average repeater is nearly a 2.0. So if that helps you at all.
Representative Dominguez, you have the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch has asked my question, so thank you.
Okay. Members, if any of you are going on the tour to Shakopee, we're leaving from the Capitol.
Really?
The Capitol?
Do you know
at 12:30 tomorrow. Ms. Falkowski, Professor Simon, Judge Dean, thank you so much for helping us with this vexing problem. If there's no further business with the committee, the meeting's adjourned.